Wow, that was so interesting. Thank you. I'd love to hear more about implicature, especially. But here's the question. So one of the things that I really think this distinction between the sort of internal and external, and what is the sentence, the external is sort of what question is the sentence probably responsive to, and the internal is something like its ways of being true or false. So I wanted to say one thing about potential interactions between the two, which is that when one is looking for false makers for a sentence, it could well be that the question under discussion would be a great source of those, that the other answers beside the one that the sentence itself gives count in practice as false makers, if you have an exhaustive notion of answers, so it's the strongest true thing that could be said. So you might think ordinarily, who brought the pizza? Ordinarily, Cleo bought the pizza, wouldn't be a false maker for Anne brought the pizza, but if there's a background question where it's understood that like exactly one person brought the pizza and there are no answers that contemplate anything else, and so in that sense it's presupposed that exactly one person did, then the false maker role. One sort of embarrassment of the truth maker approach is that it seems truth makers have to imply the truth of the sentence, and false makers have to imply the falsehood, but oftentimes in context you can get, in fact even in some of your examples, like with the MP, sort of you mentioned, like, so an MP committed a crime and you said some names of people that are probably known by you to be MPs, but I didn't know they were MPs. And so, there's the background information that person is an MP. Anyway, so I was going to say, external questions could be helpful to internal subject matters as far as providing a source of information about what count in context as false makers, namely the other answers to that question. Yeah.
One thing that I don't know, at various times you and other people, say or imply that what the internal subject matter is kind of subject to context, right? External subject matter is the most standard linguistic representation of context. And of course, there's a sense in which, you have to talk about the false makers because the external subject matter sort of like of a sentence per se can't divide up the truth makers of it because there's just one cell for the truth maker. But it does divide up the false makers. And so it's natural if you have the, if you think that internal subject matters are if you think internal subject matters are context dependent, it's true. It's one of the like most obvious things to look for is the other answers. And as you say, it fails when they're not mutually exclusive, or when they don't at least exclude the truth of the sentence itself. But that often true. I mean that's kind of to go back to your just to put two things together. When you talked about the winning a race phenomena, well, I labeled it the winning a race phenomena, but the Fido won the race can seem true even if the probability of Fido winning the race is really low. And that's because you look at the false makers of that, and if you have the question under discussion as who won the race, the false makers of it are all the individual other people winning the race, and their probabilities are also low. And so that's kind of, in your speech, how to think about that. But in the speech of I think at least Seth discussed it this way, or if not, maybe I discussed it this way in the paper with John Hawthorne and Belief, one way of thinking about what that judgment is there's just a partition, associated with the subject matter, and it's like what you think is likely is what's most likely in the partition. So it is kind of two sides of this same coin. And I agree that that's right. If you're looking at the kind of external subject matter to internal interaction, that seems like the main direction. I mean, of course, there's another interaction. I won't go on too long, but another interaction is you can have an external subject matter. Well,
You can have a subject matter that's not a subject matter of the sentence that's then influencing how you pick out the internal truth makers of the sentence.
Yes.
But, yeah.
Yeah, that last thing you mentioned is probably really important for implicature, because sometimes saying P can implicate not both P and Q, and sometimes it can implicate not both P and not Q, depending on what the question under discussion is. What the other thing is that you would have mentioned.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. But this is my last thing I'll say. I just wanted to add. So you said the external subject matter is not going to be, and this is what I always thought was an important difference. It's a potentially a source of false makers, but not a source of multiple truth makers, because the sentence itself is the one true answer to the question.
Yeah, not quite right, but yeah. I mean, I might have said that, but if you said I spoke falsely.
Right, well, okay, that's what I want to encourage you to say. So, I mean, you might think for some kinds of, like for mentioned some questions, the sentence could just be one of various possible true answers. So, my question is, what in the theory of external subject matters resources might there be for allowing multiple true answers of which the sentence uttered is only one, in which case that would greatly reduce the distance?
Yeah. So I should, because I definitely spoke falsely. I mean, if you take the, like, you know, just a standard Hamlin semantics, the 1973 semantics, the answers are not mutually exclusive. So you know, yeah. So I was wrong to think that that's not why it's the source of internal subject matters. It's rather that the different answers are kind of, you know, so I have to say, you know, suppose I say, like, you know, Lena ate dinner, then, you know, the other alternatives, if Lena's the focus value, are like Mary ate dinner, so-and-so ate dinner. And all I meant is those are not ways of making Lena ate dinner true. I was kind of building in mutual exclusivity, but that was irrelevant. It's rather that they're like, the other things are ways of making other propositions true, which is why it's kind of like the one way, in the external subject matter, the one way of making the sentence itself true is just one bit of the external, is itself a cell in the external subject matter. Yeah, and so you don't get a division of the way that cell becomes true. Except in sort of weird degenerate cases, I would guess.
Good. We have two questions. First, Matteo. Hey, you can, come here. And state your name again, so I don't
know. Okay, Matteo Plebani. Thank you so much. That was super helpful also to understand my work better. But basically, you already answered my question, but I just want to make sure I got it right. So in my account, is Spolaura's account as well. So in my account, the subject matter of a sentence like the number of planets is 9 and the subject matter of a sentence like the number of planets is 8 is the same subject matter because they are both answer to how many planets are there. And the subject matter is the number of planets in both cases, which is a set of propositions. And so there are exactly 0 planets, there is exactly 1 planet, so on and so forth. And each of these propositions, so the subject matter of a sentence A is a set of propositions, and each of these propositions either entails A or it entails not A. So there is a sense in which each of those propositions, well, it's not a truth maker in the robust sense, but in a very weak sense, each of these sentences is either a truth maker or a false maker of that. And actually, this holds in general in our account because each sentence is entirely about its subject matter, which means that that the truth value supervenes on the subject matter if two words are equivalent with respect to the subject matter. And so maybe this is a point where there is an interaction. Maybe this is exactly what you were saying in response to Steve. So there is an interaction between the internal and the external subject matter. And maybe the external subject matter is also useful to explain why, in a sense, if I say the number of planets is 9 and you reply, no, it is 8, I cannot accuse you of changing the subject. Because if we take the internal subject matter, well, you could make that accusation, but it seems wrong, at least to me.
Yeah. No, I agree. So it's interesting. What's interesting is it's a feature. So your way of doing things essentially associates partitions with sentences. And then you get this nice feature that every cell of the partition, of course, speaks to the sentence because the sentence is itself one cell of the partition. And I guess an issue is, like in linguistics, people argue about, is the semantics of questions a partition or is it, you know, something cover-like instead? And so, you know, maybe that's one argument for, I mean, I always hard to know, like, how do we decide what formal object to use as subject matter? One argument for yours is that feature of it, speaks to you. And, you know, and you could technically do your system very similarly, but do it more Hamlin 73 rather than Hamlin 58 style and not have that feature, but still get a lot of the other things. So yeah, that's a kind of incidental feature. That's the first part. Oh, I forgot about the second part now.
The other one is that sounds very strange. If I say the number of planets is 9 and the number of planets is 8.
Oh, you don't change the subject matter.
To accuse you.
I guess, this is something that I didn't talk about because I didn't think about enough. I wonder how much internal subject matters do set the subject matter of a conversation. Like, you know, we know that if you say a question, that sets the subject matter. But is it true that, like, when I say a sentence, then the subject matter of the conversation is the subject matter of the question? Now, yeah, you have an external subject matter, so that seems right. So maybe I'm just sort of constructing you as kind of an argument against, yeah. So, I mean, external subject matters set the subject matter of the conversation. Internal subject matters don't actually very naturally.
Yeah.
I mean, if I said, like, you know, Steve had a roll for breakfast, maybe I'm just amplifying your point, it's not natural. I guess, like, internal subject matter is, like, allow a follow-up. You can be like, oh, like, what did he eat on the roll? You know, it's sort of natural. It's natural to say the next question could be like the internal subject matter, but it's also perfectly natural not to have it, not to pursue it any farther. Okay, well, who else ate a roll? You know, so anyway, yeah. I guess it would be interesting to know, like, how much mileage in terms of, like, relevance, like data about what sentences are relevant, internal subject matters do. That was something I sort of put on my list of things to think about before today, but I didn't get to it in the 2 years I've had.
Good. Sally, do you want to just say your name?
Thanks. Hi, I'm Sally Hasslinger. Thanks. So this is an orthogonal question, and we
are you changing the subject?
Well, at MIT we call these the dummy questions, where someone's coming from a different area of research and thinks that it might be useful and relevant, and is trying to sort figure it all out. So it's a dummy question. So I think about questions more in the context of philosophy of science, philosophy of social science, and I'm thinking of Garfinkel, 1981, Forms of Explanation. Do you know?
Anyway. I don't.
So he thinks that explanations are answers to questions, and he's interested in both focus and foils. So what you do is you say, he's thinking about an exam, why did Mary get an A in the class? And you could have it, well, why did Mary versus Bob or Charlie or so-and-so and get an A as opposed to a B or a C or a D? And so suppose we're looking at why did Mary get the A? It's just one A in the class. Now, the question, why did Mary get the A in the class? If you think about that, I would think semantically, you could allow that any person in the class could have gotten in the A, right? Because those are all the, and in fact, but what when you're giving answers to it, he wants to set up this possibility where there's a curve. Only one person can get an A, and they get it based on their performance in the final exam. And so when you say, why did Mary get the A, the answer is, she wrote the best final exam. But that's, and so that would be true of any. If Bob got it, he would write written the best final exam. And so all of the answers are, the person in question wrote the best final exam. But that's constrained by the fact that there was this curve, there's all this other kind of background conditions that are set up. And that, so the possible answers aren't determined kind of semantically.
Yeah.
They're determined by these other considerations in the background. And he's really interested in that because he thinks that you have to take structures into account when you're thinking about the possible answers, and they often get occluded and whatever like that. So what I'm confused about is whether when we're thinking about the semantics of the question, what do we do? Do we say, presupposing that Garfinkel said an A and blah, 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 and then ask the question. So the presuppositions are, which define the structure, are part of the question. Or do we just say, well, here's the question, and then how do we decide what the possible answers are?
Yeah.
Is this a relevant question?
No, it's relevant. It's completely irrelevant. It's definitely, we haven't changed subject matter. So, I mean, you know, thinking like a kind of compositional semanticist, like the first thing to note is like the why.
Yeah.
Why did someone get an A? So like in the like Hamlin way of thinking, why has to introduce different possible ways, right? Ways of getting an A. And then like, where do those come from? I mean, so that's where the pragmatics comes in. So, you know, even when I was doing my simple examples, which I was just doing, the strategy is often you go to really simple cases to kind of get the basic structure of it and then see if it scales up. And like, there's a literature on why questions, and like, you know, it probably doesn't scale up as well as you would hope, but just thinking about it kind of my sort of mind away, you know, I said like, you know, who ate the cake or whatever. And then I just assumed, okay, in the context, there's these relevant possible people who might eat the cake. But now you're talking about a why question. Why did someone get an A? And so what does a why do for Hamlin? Well, it introduced different sort of explanations, ways of things happening. And then you have to say like, well, what are the possible ways associated with this? And then if you have a presupposition, the only way to get an A is to get the best paper, then maybe there's just one possibility for each person.
But that's not a semantical constraint. Well,
it's not a semantic constraint. I mean, it's not like the semantics gives you this like, you know, it gives you things to fill out, okay? So you think of the semantics as saying like, okay, why means we need to list different ways in which this is possible. And maybe we need to filter them by which in the context are recognized as acceptable. So you feed in the context. So the semantics is just giving you a kind of structure like, I mean, questions are context sensitive, right? Like who spoke depends on what body of people we're speaking about. Why did something happen depends on what the range of possible explanations are. So semantics is giving you this structure where then you take context and fill in the possibilities. And that's kind of where that comes in. But there's tricky questions about, you know, how does that interaction actually work? And, you know, I mean, for why, it's like, you know, for when it's who, you got a domain of individuals and we can just list them. But why, like, when do you separate different possible explanations? How do they all fit together? It's not looking so nice.
So do you think that if you put the presupposition in and articulated all the presuppositions, then semantics would give you an answer to it?
I don't think the presupposition for a why question is even like expressible.
Okay.
I mean, I think for who questions, we can like articulate what are the possible answers. We can say who of so and so and so and so. There's no like similar construction with why, you know, why of this spectrum. You know, we don't have the linguistic tools to kind of like articulate what the restrictions on a why question are, which is kind of why they're more interesting than who questions. I don't even know whether they fit in the same mold. I mean, ultimately, like, they might be something very different, but...
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Great. We have a last question with Nasta. Good, thanks.
Thank you. I'm Marta Abrashan. So I have a question about the internal subject matter, the way you think about it. And I was wondering if it also includes sort of the ways we conceptualize events that linguists actually have talked about to some extent, but very little. So for example, telic alternations, John ran for 5 minutes, or John ran to the store. That's two ways of might be two ways of describing exactly the same event, but it's sort of, it's conceptualized differently, and then there is also a linguistic aspect to it. They support different inferences, or sort of like the spray load alternations. So John sprayed paint on the wall, or sprayed the wall with paint. You know, they have different, somewhat different inferences we can draw from them, but it's sort of ways of describing exactly the same event in different ways, or even the Kahneman examples, you know, you have 20% chance of winning or losing, or 80% chance of losing, 20% of chance of winning, right? We're talking about exactly the same thing in different ways. So is that, whereas when you talk about the internal subject matter, you sort of emphasize its similarity to questions. So like with your insect examples, one has the feeling that, well, okay, we can classify a bit further or something. So it's sort of like a micro version of the external discourse-related question, right? Mm-hmm. So to my mind, the division is sort of, we have a discourse-based notion, which is the what you call the external, and then we have a cognitive version sort of the subject matter, which is the, or like what Gerdenforsch calls the event construal, the way we interpret, right, what's happening, what we're talking about, that is not based on discourse, that's not based on interaction, at least not necessarily. So I understood your sort of, that that's also partly how you look at it, but I...
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. Let me, like, there's two different ways that I feel like these, like, so you're talking about sentences, like, that are kind of extensionally equivalent in a way, but then we express them from different perspectives. And I guess, you know, in some ways, some of what Steve was saying was suggesting that these sentences could have different internal subject matters themselves, while, you know, not your particular examples, but, you know, his own kind of examples where you could have kind of sentences that are true in the same worlds, but have different ways of being true. And you might think that that's a way of that is that this framework gives you a way of capturing that by having different ways of being true, different being senses. So that's the deflationary way of I was understanding you. But the more like robust way is you're kind of saying, look, I mean, for all I'm saying, the underlying framework I'm working is ways of being true are propositions. So they're sets of worlds. So they ways of being true themselves are don't distinguish between like perspective in any kind of obvious way. Where you get the perspective distinctions in is going to have to be in what ways of being true you have. But if you kind of go some other angle and think, oh no, cognitively the way we represent these things, the way we think about them involves perspective, then you might think ways of being true themselves are kind of hyper-intentional in this way. They're not extensional, they're not intentional, sorry. And that I haven't pursued at all. I mean, you might think it's like an overkill in a way, because it's sort of like, we're all trying to like capture a little more of kind of the fine-grainedness of content in some way. So the way we're capturing more fine-grained content with the internal subject matter is we're having, instead of a proposition, sets of propositions. But then if you also then put in, oh, and the things inside are not actually propositions, but something more cognitively realistic, which can do it, then you have kind of two different ways of capturing the way extensionally equivalent things can differ. And then you want to wonder, like, well, why do we need sets or not? I mean, that's not, you might, but I'm just sort of saying, like, I'm just saying there's kind of different strategies for adding in sort of these extra kind of cognitive layers, and the deflationary strategy is to try to capture them using the sets of propositions. Inflationary is to build more in. Okay. I don't know if that's an adequate answer.
if I might ask another thing, so are the internal subject matters, are they related to particular character, so does it have to be the speakers, or could it be, are they encode a perspective of?
I don't think necessarily. I mean, I think they're like, think of them as like meanings, like, you know, a meaning, you know, the meaning of a sentence. Like, of course, there's speaker intentions and so on that go into setting the meaning, but ultimately, you know, it's not like there's no special association with the speaker. The overall linguistic context is going to give you something about what the meaning of a sentence is. So I don't think there's like special encoding of the speaker in it, at least not sort of by default.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.